From Hospice UK and Dying Matters, this is the Dying Matters podcast. I'm your host, Eleanor McConnell. Hello and welcome to episode 3 of this season of the Dying Matters podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. This week, we're chatting to Dr. Catherine Mannix. Now, if you work in any field that deals with death at all, chances are you have heard of Catherine Mannix. She is somewhat famous in our strange little community. But if you're a normal, non-death-obsessed person, here's some context. Catherine has spent her life looking after people with advanced, incurable illnesses, starting in cancer care and moving into palliative care when it was still a relatively new field. She's used that experience to become something of a pioneer, setting up the first ever cognitive behaviour therapy clinic exclusively for palliative care patients in the 90s. Having cared for literally thousands of patients at the end of life, she realised that over and over again, she was seeing patients and their families enter her care filled with fear and trepidation because they didn't know what was facing them. They didn't know what death would be like, and they had no idea how to prepare for it. Catherine felt that she needed to do more to help people, and she's now on what she calls a mission to help reclaim public understanding of death and dying. So she wrote this book, With the End in Mind, a collection of stories about people she has cared for over the years that she hopes can help us understand death and dying in a more meaningful way.
So what I wanted to do was replace the experience that we've lost by being so much better at preventing death in the prime of life. We've started sending people who are sick enough to die into hospital, which is great if what they've got wrong with them is something that can be put right. But it means that over the last 70 years, we've become unfamiliar with watching people dying of things that they don't need to die of anymore at home. So we don't know what the end of life looks like, and we're really, really frightened about it because what it looks like on television dramas is, of course, dramatic because it has to be, and it's not really very representative of normal dying. So I've called the book With the End in Mind, and it's just people's stories. They're just stories about people who the teams I've worked with have helped to look after, and it's a little glimpse into the everyday world of people at the very end of their lives. So some of them, it's about how they solved particular problems as they were approaching the end of their life. For some of them, it's actually observation at the deathbed right up to the last breath of what actually happens and how families respond to that. It's a way of just giving people back the experience that we've lost.
Yeah. And why was this crusade something that you felt it was important to take up?
And I think when I went into palliative care in the 1980s, what we believed was that within a generation we would educate other practitioners to the level where palliative care made itself redundant, that it would get incorporated into mainstream medicine, that oncologists and geriatricians and cardiologists would know palliative care as well, and that actually you wouldn't need an add-on specialty anymore.
It does sort of make sense in a way. It would be ideal if other doctors could provide that kind of care, right?
And to some extent, of course, that is what's happened, because what palliative care has done is it's opened up the conversations. And so general practice is probably the best place for doing advanced care planning, for example, because GPs and district nurses can write the plan around the services that are available in the locality where a person lives. And you can't write that in the hospital if people live in different boroughs or different towns that your hospital serves. They might all have different services out of hours, for example. But I think what we've discovered is that the body of knowledge of palliative care itself has grown and grown. We've got progressively more insightful into physical symptom management, emotional care, family dynamics, spiritual dimensions of care. And so we continue to have more to add. So even though our colleagues in the mainstream specialties are acquiring some palliative care skills, and it's fantastic that they do and that they rightly should, for their most complex patients, they still need somebody who's a specialist to refer to. And so I don't think we'll ever do ourselves out of a job. But in the early days, that's what we thought would happen. And so 30 years later, to be meeting patients coming in through the emergency department of a hospital where we'd had excellent palliative care services for 30 years and still have conversations about people being surprised that they were sick enough to die, not knowing what to expect, families saying, oh, no, we didn't let him talk about it because we thought it would be too upsetting. That was a bit depressing, really. And I started to think, you know, somebody needs to do something about the public understanding of dying. I really wish somebody would do something about this. And I kept wishing it would be somebody for a while. And then it kind of gradually dawned on me that maybe I could be that somebody. And that was a bit daunting.
Yeah.
But the more I thought it through, the more I thought, well, actually, do you know what? Because of the way doctors work in palliative care, you might have one doctor or half a doctor for quite a big team of nurses and other healthcare professionals and social care professionals, and they've all got caseloads. So doctors get to see a really great number of patients across the distribution of the teams they're working for, a whole hospice worth or a whole hospital palliative care service worth, for example. So I did the maths, and I think that through the teams that I've worked with, I've been associated with care for somewhere between 10 and 15,000 people at the very end of their lives over those 30 years. And that's huge. And it doesn't feel like that as you're kind of working day to day. You're thinking about this family here now in this moment. It's only when you stop and think about the numbers of referrals to the different services and the percent who die compared with the percent who go on to get better, suddenly think, do you know what? Actually, I've been around the block several times here, and I can probably tell enough stories about enough variety of patients and families of different structures, different ages, different ethnicities and cultures, different diseases in hospital, at home, in hospice. There's a little bit of something for everybody there. There'll be somebody who's a little bit like somebody that you know. And so there's kind of the multiplicity of ways in which different people address the idea of their life coming to a close. But underneath it, there is that that recognisable process of dying that is... Obviously, it's very, very individual to each person, just as giving birth is very individual to each woman giving birth and her babies. But the midwife by the bed is recognising the same process that she's seen hundreds and thousands of times. And in the same way, at the end of life, we're seeing a process that we can describe and that we do describe to people so that they're less surprised and less frightened about what to expect. But their individual experience of it, of course, is their very own.
Yeah. And so what is it that you want the public to understand about dying that we're not at the moment?
Well, first of all, I think we've reached a stage in our society of believing that everything's solvable. And often that everything's solvable at the flick of a screen. And so the idea that I can't be made better, that my life cannot be saved, that I am in fact mortal, is a bit of a surprise. And we do live quite a lot of our lives as though we're immortal, particularly if we're fortunate enough to have grown up in a family where there have been no deaths during our childhood and teens, nothing to bring you up short and say, oh, crikey, people die, really, people are who I love and are really important to me and I can't do without them, and they die anyway. That's very shocking. And that changes people's worldview. But most of us get into our 20s, 30s, 40s. I think I might even have got into my 50s without having an immediate close family member die. If I hadn't been seeing it at work, I wouldn't know what dying had looked like, certainly before my mid-40s. Whereas my grandmother, you know, by the time she was in her 20s, will have seen her siblings die. By her late 20s, she'd buried a child. By her early 30s, her husband had died. That was everybody's everyday experience. So the first thing is just to ask people to contemplate, just gently, the fact that we are in fact all going to die, and that some of us will die suddenly and unexpectedly, but most of us won't. Most of us will have an illness or a set of illnesses that in combination will cause our body not to be able to stay alive anymore, and that we will reach death through a process that, like labour and birth, is recognisable, that we'll mainly get more weary, and that surprisingly, dying, unlike giving birth, does not cause any pain. It doesn't cause symptoms other than weariness, onset of coma, unconsciousness, and breathing stopping. That's what dying does to us. We're going to die of something, and the something will be an illness that may cause us other symptoms as well. So some of the cancers might cause your tummy to swell, so that's uncomfortable. It might upset your breathing, so you feel breathless, or give you lumps that are pressing on things that give you pain. Heart failure can take a lot of your energy away, might make your legs very swollen and tight, might make you breathless, particularly when you lie down. Liver disease stops your blood from clotting so easily, and you get lots of bruises and tummy swelling. So each of those illnesses will have its own set of symptoms. So if you go back to that analogy of birth, labour, and before that the antenatal period, where your midwife makes sure that you're in tip-top form, well, when we're ill enough that we've got a condition that's going to cause us to die, that kind of antenatal preparatory period is about getting the symptoms sorted out.
Yeah.
So the symptoms won't necessarily get particularly worse just because we've reached the end stage of the disease. But even if they do, at that stage, our advisors, our nurses and doctors will have found out what are the drugs that help to manage your breathlessness best or your pain best, or, you know, all sorts of really important symptoms that you don't really think about till you've got them. How much it drives you mad to have itch that just never stops. You know, it's a really, really serious symptom to sort out for somebody. So there's that preparatory period of getting symptoms sorted out, so that by the time we get into the equivalent of labour, the actual active process of dying, all we've got to do is maintain symptom management. So if we're going to become progressively less conscious, we're going to be less able to wake up at the right times and take medicines to keep the symptoms away. So those drugs will now need to be given a different way, usually by injection, sometimes in a little pump. But the doses don't particularly need to change. They just need to be at the same level, but given a different way. While that process of gradually becoming less aware of our surroundings, sleeping a lot more, being awake a lot less, and then gradually becoming completely unconscious, just carries on. And then I guess the really important thing for people to understand, and the thing that I think has caused the most correspondence from the book, is the explanation about what happens to human beings, in fact, what happens to all animals, at the stage where we've lost consciousness as we're becoming comatose and moving towards death, where the only bit of the brain now that's still working is the bit that works the breathing. And so it's just an automatic reflex breathing cycle. So it's not like the breathing that we've got when we're awake. And it moves in cycles between deep and shallow and between fast and slow. And we're not aware of where our vocal cords are, so we mightn't completely relax them. So when you breathe silently, your vocal cords are open. And when you breathe and you want to speak, your vocal cords are tight and closed. But there's a place in the middle where, when you're not really managing your vocal cords, you would make a noise on an out-breath, a kind of noise. Yeah. Now, if you'd never seen that before, if you didn't know, you might think that person was groaning.
Yeah, it would sound really scary.
Yeah. You might think, oh, he's trying to tell me something, or she's got horrible pain, or she's feeling frightened. And actually, we need now to be really good midwives of dying and be able to say to families, actually, this breathing tells me that your beloved person is deeply unconscious and not aware of their breathing and not aware of that their throat is a little bit tight, so they're making that noise. And of course, we will check for other signs to make sure that there isn't any evidence that the person is distressed. But we've seen this, just like midwives, you know, we've seen it many, many times. At other parts in the breathing cycle, it can be shallow but fast. And if you didn't know better, you'd think the person was breathless.
Mm-hmm.
Or at some times it's slow but deep, and it's kind of shuddering, and it could sound as though you were struggling for breath. But actually, it's just this reflex breathing cycle. And to be able to help people to know that that's what it is, and that this dear person is actually not suffering, is actually so deeply unconscious that they're not aware of their body at all, is a really important part of helping people around the bed to be relaxed and to be able to focus on being with the person rather than being terrified about what's happening to the person. And it's a great comfort to us to know that that is what the process is.
Yeah.
And that actually the thing that happens at the very end of life is a period of much more gentle breathing, maybe with gaps. And then there will be an out-breath that just doesn't have an in-breath after it. And doesn't seem any different from any of the other breaths. There's no kind of sudden rush of funny breathing or pain or choking or panic.
Dramatic last words.
Just, no, yeah, that kind of sitting up and telling you where the treasure's buried, it really doesn't happen. So knowing what to expect, I've found, has really helped dying people to be less afraid. And, you know, I describe it to them pretty much as I've just described it now. And before I start, I always say, so let's think about what dying is going to be like. Because usually I've said, what do you think is going to happen? Then they've described something terrible. And I've said, well, actually, do you know what? It might be helpful if you know what to expect. But if you feel you want me to stop at any point, you just say, and I promise I will stop. Nobody ever stops you. Because actually what you're telling them isn't terrifying. Mm. It's quite compelling. It's actually quite interesting. If they were telling you it about somebody else, it would be really interesting. It's a bit daunting when it's about you.
Yeah.
But getting to the end and describing that last breath, and to be able to say, so if your family are in the room around you, because that's the thing that worries people, then what they'll see is something very gentle.
Yeah.
Not terribly elegant, but very gentle. We can't stop it being sad for them. They love you, and you will be dying, and they will be saying goodbye, and that's really sad, but it won't be frightening. It's not going to give them nightmares for the rest of their lives. They're not going to get flashbacks to something dreadful. And almost always what happens then is the person says, oh, well, that is not at all what I was expecting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be really helpful if my family knew that. Would you tell my family that now?
Well, yeah, because that's the thing that alleviates those kind of traumatic flashbacks, isn't it? Of someone being able to explain to them what they're seeing. Because, I mean, I remember reading in your book, there was a couple of times stories you told of family members who were incredibly distressed, who were listening to the breathing and saying, there's something wrong, he or she is in pain. And that it was only once you sort of explained to them and coached them through what was happening that they could sort of interpret it.
Yeah. And it is really important to take that very seriously, isn't it? I'm not suggesting that we say, oh, no, don't be silly. Of course they're not in pain. This is normal. It's not normal. It's the day you're dying. It's really unusual. But it's what the process of dying normally looks like. And so it's really important to hear that person say, listen, I hear that you are worrying that your brother has pain because you can hear this noise. It's one of the stories, isn't it? And actually, so here, let's check together. Let's look at him now and let's see what's happening. Let's listen to the noise that he's making. And in that story, the brother is making a very particular noise. It's the noise that we call the death rattle. And people say it as though it's something really dreadful, the death rattle.
I mean, yeah, I've heard that phrase before, but I don't know what that sounds like. Yeah. I've no idea.
Yeah, so we are evolved to protect our airway. Our throat has the most nerve endings of any part of our body, so that, well, you know, if a bit of tea goes down the wrong way, or you know, you get a crumb stuck on your tonsil, you're coughing and hacking and gagging and swallowing and really, really trying to clear your throat. And when you're deeply, deeply unconscious and you're switched off from sensation from your body, it includes even that really important part of your body to keep your airway clear. So people who are, particularly if they're lying on their backs, just from gravity, might get a bit of saliva lying in the back of their throat, or a bit of the fluid that's been used for cleaning their mouths in the back of their throat, or it could be a bit of phlegm from the chest, because that's coming up all of the time in little bits. We never notice it because we just swallow it. As soon as our throat feels it, it swallows it away. We never notice, but it's happening all the time. And once none of those things are happening and that fluid lies in the back of the throat, the air coming in and out of the lungs bubbles through the fluid. The fluid isn't bothering the person. They're not gagging. They're not coughing. But there's this bubbling noise, which is a kind of clicking noise, a kind of rattling noise, as the breath comes in and out. And when people hear it, they say, is that terrible? Does that feel awful? Is she struggling to breathe? Actually, that noise tells me that your dear person now is even ignoring the back of their throat, the most sensitive part of their body. That tells me that they're deeply, deeply unconscious. They're really, really relaxed there. They are not experiencing discomfort at all. Actually, that's a reassuring noise. It's weird. You won't ever hear it in any other circumstances. And it does come back and haunt you afterwards a little bit because it's such an odd noise.
Yeah.
But if somebody's helped you to interpret it, like a good midwife talking somebody and their birth partner through a labour, to be able to say, this is what's happening now and what I expect to happen next will be this or this. So all the time, everybody feels that they've got the story. And stories are so important to us. That's how we make sense of the world. So actually being able to know that the story is that I'll have less energy and that I'll gradually be asleep more and awake less, and that I will lapse into unconsciousness and I will be comatose and my breathing will change. And that there will be an out-breath that's just very gentle, and then I won't breathe in again. And that my family can see that, and it won't be traumatising. That's really, really important. But what's really important for us as healthcare professionals, whether we're in a hospice or at home or in a busy hospital ward, is to be coming in and keeping the family up to date and saying, OK, so this is what's happening. Kind of narrating the dying to them. And also helping them to recognise, because they're looking through sorrow spectacles, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah.
And when I've sat beside the bed of people who I love when they've been dying, for all the stuff that I know, I still also think, oh, now then, is she trying to tell me something here? Now, I know she's unconscious. I've had that conversation with so many other people about their dear person, but this is my nana. And is she trying to talk? No, actually, she's not. She's doing this respiration called chain Stokes respiration. And she's deeply unconscious and she's safe and she's okay and she's dying. But I understand why families will wonder. And so we have to come in and not just poo-poo their concerns, but actually say, okay, so this is what's happening. And here's how I'm going to tell whether or not this person is struggling and feeling distress. We're going to check that their heart isn't racing away. We're going to check that their blood pressure isn't spiking because they're experiencing something that's really uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, I mean, the way you described it in the book, you weren't sort of telling them what was happening. You were sort of like a doctor showing trainees how to do a procedure in a way. Mm-hmm. You were saying, all right, so what can you see?
Yeah.
And then they'd narrate it back to you and you'd be able to say, well, this is what it usually means.
Mm. And the best way I've always found of giving people advice, because we hate being given advice, is to ask people questions. And then get them to answer their own questions. And so, you know, you're seeing this funny breathing. What do you think it could be? And there's that guy saying to me, well, I think he's choking. I think he feels as though he's drowning. And then to be able to say, well, OK, let's imagine you've got phlegm in the back of your throat. What would you be doing? And he's saying, well, you know, I'd be coughing up, be spluttering. Yeah, you would. You're quite right. And so would I. Is he? Let's look at him now. Well, actually, no, he's not. He's just breathing in, breathing out, rattling away, but making no movement at all to try to clear that.
Yeah.
He's just completely ignoring it. It is just not bothering him. So you're helping people to discover the truth rather than bombarding them with information.
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of palliative care doctors and nurses who make that comparison with birth and death. Like the midwives through coaching someone through birth is very like what we do with death, and it is a stark difference in how we treat the two as a society. So like mothers go through all this planning for a birth, not for the pregnancy. There's a birth plan. There's a plan for immediately afterwards. There's a lot of focus now, which is great, on empowering the mother to make her own decisions about how it happens. And then, you know, when it comes to death, palliative care practitioners know that those things are an option, that you can make a plan for your death, that you can set out your preferences, that someone can be there to help your family sort of through it and explain it. But the public and people in general just either don't know that that planning is a thing that they can do, or activists don't want to make it.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? So there's a little bit of that seems to be about, oh, I can't possibly talk about that to anybody because I'll upset them. So I can't talk to my daughter about whether I can go and die in her house because I don't want to upset her.
Mm.
Like, you think she's not upset. You think she isn't watching you diminishing week by week, wondering what's going through your mind, wondering where this is all going to end. So there's something very comforting about being able to open up those conversations. They'll be tearful conversations. But that's okay. It's all right if we cry. It's all right if we feel sad. It's about loss. It's about love. And actually, the thing that becomes the most important thing, once all of the fear has been kind of put on the table and looked at, or, you know, I wouldn't want this to happen, I wouldn't want that to happen, and there are always terrible things that almost certainly won't happen, what's left is, I want to be surrounded by the people who love me most. Or I want to know they're in the next room, because actually I'm a really private person and I want to be on my own. And we have to not assume that people want to be accompanied to the very last breath. Some people give very clear instructions that actually, or there's a story in the book about a boy who says, can't have my mum sitting by the bed as I'm dying because I will be too worried about her to focus on what I need to focus on.
I also remember you said at one point that it's a very observable thing, that sometimes a lot of people die after the family have like left the room to go get a cup of tea or something.
Yeah.
In the moment where there's no one there,
that's astonishing. Absolutely astonishing how often it happens. It's so much more often than it can possibly be by chance.
Yeah.
To the extent that we, certainly in hospices, will warn families that that can happen, just so that they're not taken on the back foot, and then they just spend the first part of their bereavement feeling horribly guilty that, you know, I shouldn't have gone for a cup of tea, I shouldn't have nipped to the loo at that particular moment. And I don't know what it's about. I don't know what the science is about it.
No, I don't. And it's weird because you've just said this, we know this person is so unconscious that they're not aware of this, you know, sensation that would make any alive or conscious person panic or choke or whatever. Mm. So they're deeply unconscious. They're not physically aware of what's happening. And yet, like, they can sense when someone's in a room.
Yes, it is fascinating, isn't it? One of the things we know from intensive care units where people have been brought in with head injuries who've been deeply unconscious and, you know, are making no movements to withdraw from pain, for example. So you know the person is unconscious, is that afterwards a proportion of them can say, well, I know who came to visit me because I could hear their voices. And that's really interesting. So it may be that we still do preserve to some extent our hearing. We don't know. How would you find that out? You'd have to put people into functional MRI scanners as they were dying, which seems kind of going to be difficult to get ethics permission to do that, isn't it? But if we can extrapolate from people who've been deeply unconscious and then recovered, a considerable proportion report having had a sense of hearing, knowing that people were around them, not to be able to necessarily remember what the words were, what the conversations were, but who came. And we certainly see people being more settled when the right people are in the room and, you know, their eyes are closed and they're unconscious. So I guess the only ways that they would be able to tell would be the familiar voices of people or the familiar smells of people,
scent,
perhaps. We also sometimes notice when people are playing music in the room that deeply unconscious people synchronize their breathing to the rhythm of the music.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so that's very interesting. I love that we don't quite know all of the answers.
Because we're not supposed to.
Well, you know, I wonder how will the research progress so that we can know more and more? Because we already know things that, you know, 50 years ago we thought it would be impossible to know about. But actually, there is something very reassuring about the fact that in some way, some people have enough control that they can wait for the moment. And they might wait for the moment when there's nobody in the room. A lot of people wait for the moment when the really important person they've been waiting for arrives. Mm. And then, you know, will die within minutes of that person arriving, which is absolutely astonishing. I was talking to somebody the other day who was flying around the world to get to their father's deathbed, and phoned, the father was in Australia, phoned from their refueling stop somewhere in the Middle East, and said to the mum and the siblings, tell dad this is where I am now. He has not to feel that he's got to hang on for me. It's all right if he needs to go. And the family gave the dad that message within half an hour.
He went.
He died.
Wow.
So it was very sad for her that she didn't see him dying. But in fact, she was the medical member of the family who knew what it was to see somebody die. And in a way, she said, you know, it was important that the rest of them saw that it was peaceful, far more than it was important for me to see. I knew what they would be seeing. I was confident that it was going to be peaceful. So absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about. I mean, what's your favourite story from the book? Do you have one?
They're all my favourite stories.
Yeah.
But I think the story that is the most important story is the story of the first time I heard somebody describing dying to a patient. Because I was 4 or 5 years qualified before I moved into palliative care. I'd done general medicine and haematology and leukemias and cancer medicine. And you know, I'd seen several hundred people die. Not that I'd been at their bedside as they died, but I'd been involved in the care of people at the end of their lives, several hundred of them, even at that early stage. And of course, I'd always been the most junior doctor on any of those wards, the person who's supposed to be stopping the person from dying. So what was really interesting for me was that my boss was describing to an elderly widow who was terrified of dying badly what normal dying is like. So the first lesson that I got was that she was terrified of dying badly and everybody wanted to reassure her. You don't have to worry, it's going to be okay. And that wasn't going to help because she needed to know what was going to happen. And what he did was ask her why it would be, if you know, if she was to die in agony, what was it about that even that was worrying her? And it turned out not to really be a fear about pain at all. It was a fear about, if I die in agony and I despair in the God who I faithfully believe in, because she was a French Catholic, she'd been a member of the French Resistance in the Second World War, and had married a British airman, so had lived in Britain for a long time. But if I despair at the point of death, then that's a mortal sin, and I can't go to heaven, and I know my husband is in heaven, and we'll be separated for eternity, which is a huge, huge concept. Yeah. It's way bigger than, am I going to struggle during my last few breaths? It was much, much bigger than that.
Yeah.
And he started by asking her if she'd ever seen anybody die. And, of course, what she'd seen was her husband dying after his heart attack. And he had been awake some of the time, said all of the prayers, you know, done it properly by the way she believed was properly. So he was definitely in heaven. And she'd seen somebody die of gunshot wounds, which is not your average dying, although the process of bleeding out would be very similar in terms of becoming more sleepy and becoming unconscious. So he then said, well, I think it might help you if you understand what happens when we're dying. Would you like me to explain to you what normally happens when people die, what we see? And I couldn't believe that he was offering her that. And I couldn't believe that it was possible to offer that. So as I sat beside the bed, he talked her through this, you know, diminution of energy, sleeping more, being less awake, lapsing into a coma. And as he was talking to her, two things happened. One was that she started to sit further and further forward, just kind of latched onto what he was saying in a really calm, really attentive way. And I was listening to him, part of my brain thinking, I really can't believe that this is happening. I really can't believe that it's okay to tell somebody what dying is like. This is really awkward. I really wish I wasn't sitting here.
Oh, did you think that she'd freak out?
That kind of... I just was kind of appalled. So that's my kind of chatty, screamy side of my brain. And we've all got that chatty, screamy side, haven't we? And then the other side of my brain was listening to what he was saying. I'm thinking, do you know what? I've seen a lot of deaths. And what he's describing is absolutely right. It's just I've always been so close to the patient, so close to the drug chart, so close to the injection port, trying to stop the death from happening, that I've never stood back to say, oh, do you know what? There is a pattern here, and it's the same pattern every time. And sometimes we interrupt the pattern and save the person's life. If, you know, I'd worked on an intensive care unit, for example. But sometimes you're not going to save the person's life and the pattern is the same every time. So I was kind of, oh, yeah, I'd never really noticed that. But now he says it, that's absolutely right. So at the end of the conversation, she got hold of his hand and she kissed his hands and thanked him and then just relaxed completely and we were kind of dismissed. And I was... very tearful. It was really, really moving watching that happen. But I was moved by two things. One was what was happening to her and her appreciation that she was going to be able to do this and it wasn't going to be terrible and she wasn't going to have to worry about her immortal soul being lost from her husband's. But the other thing was, wow, what a gift that is to be able to give somebody. And we can do that because I recognise that what he said is the absolute honest truth.
Yeah.
And I could have that conversation probably not as eloquently as he's just done it, but I could say something like that and it would help people the way he's just helped her. That was a complete mind changer and game changer for me. And that's what this book is about, really. I'm trying to do that on a much bigger platform than... one person at a time and one family at a time.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense, I think. I mean, do you have a sense of what a society in which we do have a healthier attitude to death and dying looks like?
That's a good question. So let's see, where are we at the moment? At the moment, what we're trying to do is tame death. And we're trying to tame it from two different directions. So one is we're trying to sanitize it. We're trying to say all symptoms will be managed and nobody will suffer. And although most symptoms are managed and most people don't suffer horribly, there is no denying that those last few days of our lives are not the best days of our lives. No. But there will have been days in which we have had worse physical distress than those very last days of our lives. But we're almost trying to sanitise it into symptom management will control every problem. No, it won't. That's not sensible. Or we're going to defer any suffering or any ambivalence or any uncertainty by moving to offer people assistance with dying at a point that they choose when they say they don't want any more. And, of course, a few people, if that were available, would avail themselves of that and they'd be comforted by that. But we still would need the rest of society managing death as a thing that happens for all of the people who wouldn't choose that. So it's not as though we're going to have either palliative care or assisted dying or euthanasia. If we legalise assistance with dying, we will still need palliative care for all of the people who want to live their best lives up to that point. And all of those people who want to live their best lives and never make that choice. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that rather than trying to tame it and manage it and sanitize it and, you know, make it a thing you can do from the screen of your phone, we need to become a society that goes back to saying, actually, in the end, what's really important? What's important to us? And we know what's important because dying people drop all of the stuff that isn't important and they really focus on what's important. And what's important to people is who they believe themselves to be, what they've achieved in their lives in terms of relationships. That seems to be more important than whether you are the CEO of a major bank.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually how have your kids turned out or have you been a good member of your golf club. So it's about what are the ripples in the world that I will leave behind me, and are they good? And if they're not good, I want to try and redress it. So many people reach out to try and solve old arguments. Some people reach out to just reignite old arguments, but that is unusual. Most people are actually reaching out to say, I'm sorry, or reaching out to say, I forgive you. Let's just forget about that and let it go. They want to express gratitude. So one of the things that's really lovely about working in a hospice, which I've worked in several hospices over my career, is that patients and families really, really appreciate the care that they're getting, and they are very, very grateful. But in fact, that also happens in hospitals, and it also happens when people are at home. But they want to express gratitude, much more importantly, to their important people throughout their lives. And I've seen people writing letters. I had a young person once who wanted to write letters to the teachers who'd been important to them at college and university, for example, as well as family and immediate friends. So there's thank you, I'm sorry, I forgive you, but I love you is the most important one. And as a society, if we're not good with the D words, like we don't like to say dying and death and dead, we do passing and slipping away and lost.
Yeah.
But we're really, really awkward with the L word as well. So the idea that you would tell somebody that you love them and that this lifelong friendship is deeply appreciated as a love and not just a friendship thing.
Yeah.
That's what people are feeling, but they're very awkward about saying it. And there's something very freeing about thinking you're at the end of your life that seems to let that embarrassment drop away and people start to say those things. So I think a society where those things can be valued up front when you're not just in your last few weeks of your life.
Something about being more emotionally open than we are
yes.
at the moment.
Yeah, and more emotionally aware of other people's emotions. We've got this policing of language where, you know, you and I will be talking to each other about the death of, you know, my friend. And you say to me, I'm really sorry to hear that your friend has died. And I say, thanks, that's really nice of you. And then I go out to fill the kettle. And another person who happened to be in the room comes over to you and said, that was really insensitive of you to say dead in front of Catherine like that. So it's not that we're policing our language. There's the thought police as a third party. And now we're starting to think, so if I want to say the word dying or dead or death, is there anybody in this room who's in some way going to take against that word being used?
Yeah.
Not because I'm saying it in a way that's disrespectful and hurtful, but in that kind of moral outrage, unhelpful way of somebody policing somebody else's language. Because in my practice, I only use the real language for things, dying, dead, death.
Because you have to be clear.
Because you don't want it to be ambivalent. You know, I've met so many families. As a palliative care lead for a big hospital, I used to meet anybody who made complaints about deaths. And the commonest cause for a complaint would be somebody saying, we didn't realise. We would have been there. We would have changed everything. We would have dropped everything. We didn't realise they were so sick. And when you look in the notes, you can see that they've been told that the person is critically ill, that this is very serious.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody said, your beloved person is sick enough to die. And we're trying to stop the dying from happening, but you need to know that at the moment, that is a possibility and you might want to be here. So we need to use the language. We need to own the language and we need to stop being offended by the language. I think when we're bereaved, sometimes those words are too hard. And sometimes we need to use softer language just to get ourselves and the people who are grieving with us through it. So we've got absolutely no right to be policing the language of the bereaved and tick them off because they're not using, you know, death, dying, dead. But the media need to just shape up and start using the D words. And people who are working in a public space in bereavement counselling or medical care of any sort need to be using the D words. And I know from my clinical experience that I can have a very tender conversation with a dying person or with somebody who loves a dying person in which I will be using those words and I won't be offending them. It might be hurting them because it's a fact. But they don't think, oh, she was unkind to me. She used horrible words. they think that was a sad conversation in which that kind doctor made very clear to me that things are moving towards the death of this person that I love and we need to get our act together.
Yeah.
So we can say them with tenderness, we can say them with kindness, and to use the L word, we can say them with love, and it's okay.
I can't really add anything to Catherine's words there. I think they're perfect, and an amazing thing for everyone to remember when they're dealing with death and dying. Whether you're a doctor who deals with it every day, or just a person trying to find a way through for yourself. Absolutely check out Catherine's book if you can. It is beautifully written and was shortlisted for a Wellcome Book Prize. It does come with a disclaimer that you might find it an emotional read, but if you do cry when reading it, don't worry, you aren't alone. I did too. You can find Catherine on Twitter at Dr. Catherine Mannix. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back with another episode next week.